Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. In this episode, I'm joined by co-host Kate Fulham. Kate and I recently interviewed Anne Druyan. Anne was the creative director of the Voyager Interstellar Message Project, also known as the Golden Record, carried aboard the twin spacecraft launched in 1977. With her late husband, Carl Sagan, Anne co-wrote Cosmos, a personal voyage, which originally aired on PBS in 1980. More recently, she was part of the Emmy and Peabody award-winning team that wrote and produced Cosmos, a space-time odyssey hosted by Neil deGrasse Tyson. Just after our interview, it was announced that a sequel, Cosmos Possible Worlds, will be airing on Fox in 2019. Last year, Anne Druyan oversaw the audible recordings of all of the books that were written by the Sagan-Druyan writing team, as well as works authored only by Carl Sagan. So sit back and enjoy the conversation between Anne Druyan, Kate Fulham, and myself. Well, it's just such a pleasure to talk to you, and I can't believe it's been 10 years since I spoke to you last.
Has it been that long? I know we've been in touch occasionally over the years, but yes, it probably was. It's probably been 10 years since our most recent conversation, and that's too long.
It is, and that's partially my fault. But I wanted to congratulate you on such a productive and wonderful decade and maybe get your comments on the highlights of it. You had, of course, Cosmos, a space-time odyssey hosted by everyone's favorite scientist, Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's one of my favorite anyway. And that won Peabody and Emmy Awards for you, right?
That's right. And I think Neil did a wonderful job presenting the scripts that Steve Soter and I wrote for him. And, you know, I picked him because I knew that he could really connect in a way that was similar to the way that Carl did, and also that even people who didn't realize that they had any prior interest in science or the universe could really feel it. And I think he just did a magnificent job.
He did. It's a wonderful series. I'm just curious, what was that like? How did you first reach out to him? Did you just get on the phone and say, hey, Neil, would you like some very, very large shoes to fill?
No. Well, first of all, I've known Neil since he was, I think, in his early 20s. And we've stayed in touch. And when I first decided that I wanted to do a wholly new Cosmos, he was the first person I thought of. And, of course, Steve Soter, who had been our collaborator on the original series with Carl. And so I got together with him and with Neil and with Mitchell Kenold. And the four of us began this adventure together. And Steve and I figured out the stories we wanted to tell, wrote the scripts, went to various. And they all wanted to do Cosmos, but really it was only Seth MacFarlane and Peter Rice at Fox who understood, you know, that I had this vision that would require the kind of financing that shows that are really more about car crashes and robberies and other things usually get without anybody, you know, mumbling any disagreement. And I wasn't going to do Cosmos anywhere where we didn't have the production values and the VFX and the transporting cinematic quality that I think the story of cosmic evolution requires. So we were very lucky that Seth MacFarlane was our champion. He brought us to Peter Rice. And so we, you know, Neil was part of the team from the very beginning, and I never wavered in my sense that he was the right guy for the job.
It was wonderful, and then of course on top of that, Voyager turned 40. It's been 40 years of the Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft touring the outer planets, and then of course in 2012 Voyager 1. Crossed into interstellar space, and that was another fantastic milestone in your last decade.
Absolutely. I mean, the triumph of creating a spacecraft that could pass through the heliopause, that place where the wind from the sun dies down and gives way to the interstellar medium, that is, you know, an epical achievement. And then the 40 years is a kind of biblical time span. And what's so remarkable is just in the last few weeks, you probably are aware that JPL sent a command to Voyager 1.
Yes.
To start up her thrusters, and no such command had been given since 1987. So you have a car that you last drove in 1987, and you put the key in the ignition because cars built in 1987 required that, and it starts up the first time you step on the gas. It's just such a remarkable tribute to a technology that was, you know, let's remember that Voyager was launched in 77. That's only 20 years after Sputnik, after our very first foray off the planet. And a mere 20 years later, we already knew how to build a spacecraft and design its trajectory so brilliantly that it could give us our first close-up look at the outer solar system and its moons, as well as take our music and our greetings and our sounds and our images and take them to not only beyond the inner harbor of our little part on the cosmic ocean, but also to conceivably 5 billion with a B years from now. Really astonishing.
Wow.
And
well,
being part of that, what an honor. You know, what an honor to touch something when you're 27 and then 40 years later to be able to say that it still has the power to move people everywhere on Earth and to inspire them. And it's still functioning.
Before we move on to, I want to talk about the Audible projects, but before we do that, I just want to point out that you, of course, and Timothy Ferris and your late husband, Carl Sagan, were responsible for the Voyager records. And, you know, everybody knows about Chuck Berry being on there, but my favorite thing on the record is that your brainwaves from the day you proclaimed your love for Carl are also on that record.
Yeah, it's actually 3 days after, pretty close, but 3 days after Carl and I proclaimed our love for each other. And that's what was coursing through my ecstatic, euphoric brain when my thoughts of an hour-long meditation were compressed into sound to be included on the record. And I'm so happy that I did that. I had asked Carl if it was possible that they would ever be interpreted. And he looked at me with a big smile and said, you know, a billion years is a long time, Annie. Go do it. And you know, to think that joy will survive no matter how foolish and short-sighted we are on this world. No matter what we do to this planet and our species and the other species on it, that the two Voyagers will carry that joy with them into the next several billion years is mind-boggling.
And we're joined, of course, today by our good friend and sometimes co-host, Kate Fulham. Kate, welcome. And that was a pretty romantic story, wasn't it?
I just love the way you speak, Anne, about science, about just the way that science and art and love and feelings and everything intersect. It's really inspiring. And I think that's one of the ways that science can be communicated successfully. And you've had such a long and successful career doing that. How did you approach the task of revealing sometimes the disappointing truth about what we're discovering in science, but also inspiring people to help solve some of the problems that our species has created?
Well, first of all, let me say, Kate, I'm really happy to be talking with you. And
thank you
so much for the very kind and extremely gratifying lovely things that you just said. I'm very grateful to you for them. Now, you said disappointing truths, some of the disappointing truths that science reveals, and yet I'm not aware of any. Truthfully, I feel that what science reveals, remembering every moment that it can never be an absolute truth that might not be disproven at some future date. But whatever science reveals is what I want. I love reality, and I would much rather, you know what's up than ever be confirmed in my delusions. And so my method for communicating science is simply being the person who was excluded from science in my youth and remembering who I am and that I was a scientific outcast. I was someone who had great difficulty with math and science, even in high school. And as I went further, I had, college professors who would just completely give up on me because they thought I was ineducable. And so I'm always remembering that that's really who I am. And I was, of course, ridiculously fortunate to cross paths with Carl Sagan, probably the greatest teacher of the last, millennium. And he was willing to give me a 20-year tutorial in science, which I cherish, and which really opened the gates of the wonder world to me, made me realize that, first of all, we're a story-driven species. And if you can find the story in these remarkable truths that science is revealing about nature, then you're in. Because all of us, are historically bound to each other by stories. And we have a long, ancient legacy of sitting around the campfire and sharing these stories with each other. And so, if you can find the narrative, then anything is understandable. And I say that, even, I think it's even true of quantum mechanics, which I think is the most difficult subject to really wrap your head around, that even quantum mechanics can be understood as long as you have a tolerance for ambiguity. And if you're willing to embrace the ambiguity of nature, then once you can relax that natural resistance, then I think, the universe is yours.
That's true. I mean, I've been digging into shadows of our forgotten ancestors, and I loved when I read science is never finished. And as you've pointed out, learning is never finished. We have so much more to learn. And if we're open to it, it's really amazing the things that you can learn. I also really loved your optimism really shines through in everything that you say and the things that you're writing and producing, that there's such beauty and story that can be shared in order to help people come together around some concepts that can be difficult to learn. And I really love that perspective.
Thanks, Kate. Thank you. Well, I feel like it just has a demonstrated efficacy in terms of, if I understand it, then I believe I can make everyone understand it. And if I don't understand it, then, we're not there yet. When it's we can't tell the story yet, because I feel like, I just feel this oneness with the audience and identify far more with the people who feel excluded from science than those who are its practitioners and high priests.
Well, I can't think of a better way to include people in science than reading the collective works of Andrew and Carl Sagan. And what was so wonderful is last year in 2017, I'd like to ask you about the Audible project, because it looks like just about the entire catalog was released or re-released on Audible. Can you tell us a bit about the genesis of that?
Yeah, I loved doing this. First of all, these are wonderful people to work with, both Audible and Brilliance, which is the company that really actually does the hands-on producing of these audiobooks. And it was one of the most delightful projects I've ever worked on, because the people at Brilliance came to me with a sense that they just wanted to really serve the collected works of Carl Sagan and, to a lesser extent, mine, and that they understood that it was kind of a historic opportunity. And they went about it in a way that we had complete agreement on, you know, the voices, on the way the packaging. There wasn't any aspect of the production that we didn't find, that, you know, I didn't feel completely in sync with them. And working with Sarah Mozell, who directed many of them, we were really excited to enlist Seth MacFarlane, the wonderful Carrie Elwes, just a really impressive list of people who, and Carl, of course, we were able to, I was able to find the masters from Pale Blue Dot. And I actually found them in connection with the producing episode 13 of A Space-Time Odyssey, of the 2014 Cosmos series, and listened to them for the first time in the course of producing that series. And to hear Carl's voice, not, you know, the one you hear on YouTube or Vimeo, or, you know, which has been through how many, no one knows how many iterations. Or, for instance, to have Nick Sagan, Carl's son, and Clinette Minnis do the voices of Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, that, you know, would have meant so much to Carl, as well as Dion Graham, who I think did a sensational job on Broca's Brain. So we felt really, really lucky that that we had an amazing group. I'm sure I'm leaving some of the great voices out. Adrian Moore and
LeVar Burton.
And Relay. Yes. And who are you going to say?
LeVar Burton.
Oh, God, that's who I was trying to think of. LeVar Burton, exactly, for Cosmos. Who is a friend of mine, and who also has that ability to connect. He's such an enlightened being, and a person who's just so curious and interested in science, and has that kind of, you know, has what Carl had and what Neil has, you know, that kind of that passion to communicate and to touch the soul of the person you're talking to. It's very personal. So it was a tremendous experience. I mean, one of the things that is so comforting to me, you know, Carl's been gone for 21 years. And yet, what's just so moving to me is that I think more people love him and understand the prophetic things that he was saying back then ever before. You know, he's a person who is justly venerated, loved, respected. And it's my astonishing good fortune to be able to kind of affirm, you know, the people have a kind of dream of who Carl was, and yet I know firsthand that he was much more than that. And that's the amazing thing. So, you know, when you lose someone you love, you just, your terror is that they're going to sink beneath the waves and people will forget who they were and what they were about, and you'll be the only witness. And I'm so lucky that that so many people have such a deep feeling for who he was.
My heart hurts right now, but in a good way.
Mine too. I think, I mean, it's really amazing the way that you speak about all the people that you've worked with, Anne. And I have a sense that a lot of the projects that you've worked on have risen to the forefront because of your involvement in them as well. I mean, it's really just inspiring and so optimistic the way that you speak about things. I really am enjoying digging into the Audible project that Dave was talking about and that we were just referencing. You must be so proud that your family continues to be a voice for science, and having Nick involved with the recorded book was amazing. I mean, how did you, as a member of the family, introduce the children to the concept of stewardship in an approachable way, and standing up and speaking their voice about science?
Well, I have to say Nick is a total self-starter. He didn't need anyone to point him in that direction. He was, I think, the youngest staff writer in the history of Star Trek. And I remember the thrill of watching two episodes of Star Trek that he was credited as the sole author of. I watched them with Carl in our house. And we were both sort of snuggled up in the greatest, parental pride and joy. Nick is a great soul and a great mind. And he just, he was born that way. As I feel the same way about Sasha Sagan, who has been writing articles and giving talks on a lot of these same subjects.
You're listening to Blue Dot on NSPR. When we return, Kate Fulham and I will continue our conversation with Andrewian. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's return to our conversation with Kate Fulham and Andrewian. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot.
When I read Carl's books and your books, I always hear his iconic voice in my head. And so I had a little bit of trepidation. I was like, well, am I going to like these because it's not his voice unless you're listening to a pale blue dot? And what I found the experience was like, when you take a great song by the Beatles or Bob Dylan and somebody does a wonderful cover of it, they breathe fresh life into it. And it's wonderful. And that's the experience I had, for example, listening to LeVar Burton narrating Cosmos.
I completely agree. Because, there's one version which is informed by the thoughts that led up to the framing of that sentence or phrase. And then there's another version, which is, possibly even more universal, which is the person who comes to it and finds in it the thing that touches them, that reaches them, or the thing they most want to communicate to the listener. So I agree with you. There's, it's all to the good.
But I would like to know a little bit, if you could share with us, what was the process of writing with Carl like? What was that like? Well, tell us about how that worked.
It was so fun because for us, it was another form of making love. And there were an infinite number of different ways of making love, and this was one of them. So what we would do generally is, for any given book or for Cosmos, the original series, or for Contact, the motion picture for which we wrote the treatment, which was almost as long as a film script, it was 110 pages, and and one of the drafts of the screenplay, we would divide up the very, we'd go through the whole thing. In fact, there's a board, which I believe is now in the Library of Congress, in which every sequence in our version of Contact, of the screenplay, is a sequence label, every single sequence, and then there's either a C or an A next to it, which means, you know, it was either his responsibility or mine. And so we would go to our separate corners. He always never used a laptop or a computer, never. He spoke into dictation machines. Sometimes he'd have three going at the same time for three different projects. I don't know how he kept track of which was which. But he had a very small army of people who were taking the recording tapes and turning them into manuscript. And then he would go through another iteration of editing it. But meanwhile, I would go off to my office, and very often I would be sitting at my desk, which looked out on the beautiful, on Ithaca, and the lovely Lake Cayuga, and just gorgeous out there. And Carl would be sitting outside, even in Ithaca, which, as you know, is in the Northeast and can get very cold. He would be out there 10 months of the year at least. He'd be sitting at a table, and I could see him, and he could see me, although we were at least 100 feet away from each other. And I would write on first a typewriter and then later on my laptop. And we would bring our chapters to each other. Of course, anything that was highly technical scientifically, he would do the first drafts on all of those. And if it was either cultural history, as in Comet, you know, history of the lore of comets, or scientific history, the life of Edmund Halley, things like that, I would do myself. And then what was so much fun was to sit at our table, at our dining room table, and I would hand him my pages, and he would hand me his. And it was like a love offering. It was so thrilling. And every, you know, of course, I felt so lucky to be reading these pages for the first time. One of the great writers, thinkers, teachers of the world was handing me his copy to edit, and I was handing mine to his, and every once in a while he would burst out in this wonderful laugh, which actually was the very first sound that I ever heard him make at Nora Ephron's apartment when I first met him the night I met him. Before I even got into the apartment, I heard this laughter that was so uninhibited and free. And I was thinking to myself, whose laugh is that? That's a great laugh. And so if I could make him laugh like that, sort of that wonderful mental hospital laugh that's actually on the Voyager record, I would, it was my greatest joy. I would feel, and, you know, if I wrote something that he thought was really good, he would make this gesture of taking a pretend hat off his head and doffing it to me. And, or he would even say, hats off to you, Annie. And I just remember the ecstasy of that feeling of finding a way to express an idea that really impressed him. I was always like, before I knew Carl, you know, if you wanted to torture me and make me spill all my secrets and turn in my best friends to the authorities, all you'd have to do would be to put me on a roller coaster, because I just am one of those people who can't bear that sinking pit at the stomach feeling. But once I was with Carl, I felt I could go on roller coasters, I could speak in public, I could do anything, really, because I felt like, wow, you know, if he thinks I'm smart, then I have nothing to worry about. And that was the joy of us writing together. You know, there were moments of disagreement. I don't want to make it seem as if, you know, we were inhuman and, you know, we were somehow, you know, free of all of the problems and issues that people have. There were moments of disagreement, but they were very few and far between. And we would polish each other's copy and suggest different words, suggest a new idea, and it would go back and forth, back and forth. And mostly I would just, I would read, for instance, his manuscript. And I have such a bad handwriting, I would just make little check marks over the places where I had a new idea or a word to substitute or question something. And we would go through them, and I could remember each and every one just by the check mark. And he would talk the change into his dictation machine, and we would proceed from there. But it was fun. It was a feast of ideas. I look back on all the time we spent together writing those books and speeches and articles for Parade Magazine and the shows for Cosmos and Contact, and just think of that as just some of the most truly idyllic, thrilling, stimulating, exciting moments of my whole life.
And it sounds like you really had an equal partner there, which is so important in marriage and work life. And, you know, you're lucky enough to have had them all bundled into one. You know, you were able to inspire and encourage each other, but also have that healthy respect to disagree, which I think is so important. And, you know, there's been this worldwide movement now bringing attention to the obstacles women face in the workplace. And I wondered if you would mind sharing your own experience building your career.
Kate, I'm so glad you asked me that. That's awesome. Because here was Carl, who was born in 1934. So he was of that other world that really, you know, a generation of men who really were notorious for their disregard for what women had to say. And that was kind of the miracle of it was, and that's why I was so happy, and that's why he was so happy, because I think it's fair to say, without in any way diminishing the other people in his life, that he had never truly been in love before. And I think when you have that experience, it's like being on another planet, and it opens you up to so many things. And I have to say that even before we knew each other, he had shown in many different ways that he had a kind of respect for all people. That was exceptional for his time and place of origin and experience. I was really struck by how, you know, there's a book he wrote before he ever knew I existed by 7 or 8 years. The Cosmic Connection. And if you look in the index under chauvinism, it's carbon. It's the only chauvinism that he had. He was a carbon chauvinist. He really admitted it about life and the universe. But, you know, he was also a guy who in 1962, I think it was, you know, was a postdoc at Harvard. And what did he decide to do? He decided to go to the all-black colleges in the South and teach a course called The Search for Intelligent Life on Earth. He was a person, I mean, not many astrophysicist postdocs were doing that. He was the kind of person who encouraged a great many women scientists who were really existing in an extremely hostile environment. I think of Carolyn Porco, and she talks about giving one of her first talks, I believe, first lecture at the AAAS. Carl sitting in the front row, and at the end of her talk, congratulating her on what a really first-rate talk it was, and asking a question, which was clearly meant to give her an opportunity to say more. And I mean, he was like that to begin with before I met him. But the thing that was so extraordinary about him was that he knew that the greatest thing in love is to send back to the other person this even greater love, to go higher and higher and to keep going higher in every way you can think of, and never level off and never be satisfied with where you are, that you can always go deeper and higher. And so in the beginning, the first project we ever worked together was on a project for the Children's Television Workshop, which was essentially a kind of Cosmos for kids. This is before Cosmos and even before Voyager. And we could see immediately, there were other people involved in the project, but we could see immediately that we just had this, we were on the same slightly odd wavelength, slightly unusual wavelength, and we were there together. And that's why he asked me if I wanted to work on the Voyager record and then to collaborate with him on Cosmos. And in the beginning of Cosmos, this is now late 77, early 78, we would find ourselves in a room full of people, and every time I opened my mouth, some guy would interrupt me. And Carl would say very gravely, but excuse me, I really would like to hear what Anne has to say. And every time I did get to say something, the next day, some man in the room would turn to Carl and say, you know, I really like that idea you had yesterday about so-and-so. And Carl would say, oh, I think you
wow.
mean Anne's idea. I think you mean Anne's idea. This happened so often that he was always right there, right on it. He understood that there was a species-wide problem for men with being able to hear what women were saying, to let them finish, and to even give them credit for what they said. And so he was so strict about this that I think it probably annoyed some of the other producers on the show, but he retrained them so that by the end of the project, they didn't interrupt me. I got to speak my mind, and I just really, I think back how it wasn't just being protective. It wasn't, you know, obviously they probably had their resentments because it was like, who is Carl's girlfriend? Why is she here? You know, like, wait a minute. You know, what is she doing here? But he also knew that even after I had kind of earned my place at the table with the work I did and the ideas I had, that they still begrudged me that place. And he wasn't going to stand for it. But he was doing it in a way that was instructive. It wasn't punitive. It's very wise.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think, you know, not to poor Dave over here, you know, we don't want to put all the men down, but, you know, there was a time where, it, you know, that was a species-wide issue or you know, a gender-wide issue. I think it's also important as we go forward to, you know, raise awareness of the issues that women are having in the workplace and in life, but also support one another as humans, right? So it can be a hierarchical issue as well, right? Someone who's in a higher position of power versus someone in a lower position of power. And I think kind of where we started with that, the science is not finished, learning is not finished, and collaboration is not finished either, right? And we need to be aware that sometimes maybe the lower person on the totem pole may have something more to say and something really illuminating to say. It's very interesting.
Exactly. And he was that person because, you know, you could ask him any question and he never made you feel stupid for asking a question. In fact, he just immediately retraced his own thought steps of how he came to understand this particular phenomena. He would help you every step of the way. I mean, he really understood that. And I wasn't the only woman in our working experience who felt that. I mean, I think of Linda Obst, who was our producer, collaborator on Contact. And the very fact of making Ellie Arroway the hero of the whole story, and that came about because we wanted to tell a story, a great adventure story, in which, for once, the woman didn't stay home like Penelope.
Right.
The woman went on the adventure, and the guys stayed home. And that was the whole. That was the origin of Contact. Was we wanted, at that time when we were first conceptualizing it, people, men like to say things like, "Well, if women are as smart as men, where are the female Leonardos?" And of course, I had found Hypatia in writing Cosmos, and someone who no one since the 19th century had given a single thought to Hypatia until she appeared on Cosmos. And she was the answer to that question. Well, if you are a female Leonardo, they'll carve you to bits with abalone shells, and they'll kill you.
Oh my goodness.
And that was kind of the answer to that question. So that he was, he was that way across the board.
That's amazing. And I want to give Dave a chance to interrupt us because we've taken so much of your time. You've been so generous. And I think our conversation has gone a little bit long. This has been so terrific. Thank you.
Well, I hope my answers, I think it's my fault because my answers have been too rambling. But I just really wanted to give you, the full flavor of the joy of that relationship. And also, and I just want to say one thing finally, and that is I feel very strongly, I'm not sure I'm a humanist because I feel a connection with other species, and I'm not sure that name will withstand the test of time if we ever do make contact with some of the other intelligent life on this planet. I am a feminist. But I am a feminist in the sense that I really believe that the future of the species really depends on equality. Really, everyone. Equality for everyone. And, of course, that includes women. And I also think you're reading Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, which has a very strong message about our non-human primate relatives and
yes.
The ways in which females mediate the testosterone besotted males and bring them back to their senses. So, yeah. So I'm sorry for giving such long answers, but we're living in a moment where people are really awakening to these truths. And I'm really proud that we had something to say about that a long time ago.
Well, this testosterone besotted male just wants to thank you very much.
You're so welcome, Dave. Really appreciate it. So good to talk to you again. Kate, what a pleasure to make your acquaintance.
You too, Anne. Thank you.
And I don't think I've ever said this to any one of my guests ever before, but I just deeply feel the need to say that I love you very much, Anne.
I feel it, David. I really do. And I really hope we'll get a chance to talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks to our guest, Anne Druyan. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll hear about the strange and fascinating world of the sea louse with Cheryl Hosler. Stay with us.
Thank you.
And we're back. Our next segment is a special report on the lives of the aquatic parasites known as sea lice. Our guest reporter is Cheryl Hosler, host of the YouTube channel, The Roving Naturalist.
Parasites. For most of us, the word conjures up images of tiny bloodsuckers that make our skin crawl. Your mind is probably recoiling from the thought of ticks, leeches, and tapeworms. But parasites, a surprisingly diverse group of organisms, have developed ingenious methods of survival. Rather than making their own food using energy from the sun, like plants do, or foraging or hunting for food, like animals do, parasites get their food directly from a host organism, often while living on or inside the host for their entire lives. It actually sounds relaxing, being able to just sit inside your food. While thinking about it may give you an attack of the heebie-jeebies, it's usually not in a parasite's best interest to kill its host. Why spoil a perfectly good food supply by causing it to deteriorate? So, unlike the average puma or crocodile attack, an otherwise healthy animal host can usually survive a minor infestation of parasites. Deep in the ocean, you might encounter Cymothoa exigua, the tongue-eating louse, inside the mouth of any of several large fish. Tongue-eating lice are arthropods, meaning they're distantly related to insects, spiders, and crabs, with jointed legs and a nice, crunchy outer shell. The tongue-eating louse is a kind of isopod, so it very closely resembles the pill bugs, roly-polies, or wood lice found in your basement or backyard. Well, except for the fact that the females can be up to an inch long. Like all isopods, these creatures have seven identical pairs of jointed legs, shield-like plates armoring their backs, and bodies that range in color from creamy yellow to gray. Cymothoa exigua is just one kind of tongue-eating louse, all of which employ the same method of parasitism. A female louse in a host fish will move into the fish's mouth, bite through the blood vessels at the base of the tongue, and drink the blood until the fish's tongue shrivels up and falls away, leaving just a stub. Once the tongue is out of the way, the female louse uses specialized claws to grasp the tongue stub on the bottom of the fish's mouth, taking up the space where the tongue once was. Oddly enough, the presence of the parasite doesn't seem to cause the fish any undue stress. Host fish caught during research on the louse seem to maintain normal breathing and eating patterns. This may be due to the fact that the tongue-eating louse, while definitely a parasite, is surprisingly cooperative. Not only does the female louse take up the space of the fish's tongue, but she seems to take on the functions of the missing tongue as well. As she sits in the bottom of the mouth, the fish is able to use her as a sort of prosthetic tongue for swallowing and pressing food bits up against the fish's primitive tooth plates. The louse continues to eat blood, mucus, and food bits in the fish's mouth, but causes no more obvious damage. This might sound strange, and quite a bit more cooperative than most parasites we're familiar with. While a parasite acquires nutrition at the expense of its host, the role the tongue-eating louse plays in its host makes the relationship feel much more like mutualism, where both organisms benefit from each other's actions. However, since the relationship starts with the louse biting off the fish's tongue, it's safe to say that this is definitely a case of parasitism. How does the female louse get into the fish's mouth in the first place? Isopods in this group are all protandrous hermaphrodites, meaning every individual starts out its life as a male. The tiny males take up residence in the gills of host fish, where they drink blood from the vessels in the gills, which may cause small amounts of inflammation, but no other harm. If no female is present in a particular host, one male will transform into a female, move into the host's mouth, and start secreting a pheromone that prevents any other males from turning into females. When the lice are mature and ready to reproduce, a male will crawl from the host's gills into the mouth, mate with the female in the fish's mouth, and then crawl back to his home in the gills. After putting the fish through the humiliation of having two other animals mate in its mouth, the female louse produces a brood of all male offspring who will swim off to find a new host and repeat the cycle. Cymothoa exigua is a rather advanced species, parasitically speaking. Most other lice in the Cymothoidae family live as ectoparasites, clinging onto the outer skin of their fish hosts. but the tongue-eating louse, with its more complex survival strategy, is better hidden and difficult for cleaner fish to find and remove. Most ectoparasites of large fish are removed by shrimp and smaller fish at cleaning stations scattered throughout coral reefs and other marine habitats. These cleaning stations demonstrate a clear case of mutualism, because the big fish get their skin cleaned in exchange for not eating the smaller fish. In return, the smaller fish do the work and get a meal in the bargain. But because the tongue-eating louse is hidden in the host's mouth, it's safe from these efficient cleaners. Tongue-eating lice can live in a wide variety of hosts, though all of them are fish. A photo finalist in the underwater category of the Wildlife Photographer of the Year 2017 contest shows three clownfish with lice peeking out from their open mouths. While many parasitic animals don't even have eyes because they spend their entire lives in the warm, dark interiors of their hosts, the tongue-eating lice do have tiny faces to help them navigate around their hosts' mouths. While the award-winning photo shows lice in small clownfish, these parasites are more commonly found in snappers, grunts, and other large fish harvested for food. This has led to a few cases where people have tried to sue their grocers for the presence of lice in their fish, claiming the lice made them sick when they ate the fish. But don't worry, the presence of tongue-eating lice in the water or in a fish you bought at the market can't harm you. They aren't poisonous, and though live lice may try to bite to defend themselves when removed from their fish, they are unable to cause serious injury. Tongue-eating lice are just trying to make a living, like every other amazing form of life on this planet.
Thanks again to our guests, Cheryl Hosler, her YouTube channel is The Roving Naturalist, and Andrewian. You can check out the entire catalog of Carl Sagan and Andrewian books on Audible. Special thanks to our friend and sometimes co-host, Kate Fulham. Kate left the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science to pursue her passion for sustainable, locally sourced foods as the new executive director of the Amagansett Food Institute on Long Island. We wish her well in her new endeavor and hope to have her back with us in the near future. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Check out this and past episodes on mynspr.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. You can follow us on Twitter at NSPR News or me at Dave Shlom. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and co-produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.